So today we're going to continue with our great character study, and we're going to look at Nehemiah. Nehemiah is generally held up as a great example of leadership, and conventional wisdom is something that's often off base. But in this case, I actually think it's on track, because Nehemiah did something really terrific. And what we're going to do is look at some characteristics of leadership and how those characteristics are exemplified by Nehemiah. So first, let me just talk about what leadership is, some characteristics of leadership, and then what we'll do is go through this book of Nehemiah, and as much as time allows, just see examples of how Nehemiah exhibited these characteristics of leadership. So leadership is, in its simplest form, just getting somewhere that you're not, and really even just starting to go somewhere you're not. So the easiest visual example is a mountain. Mountains are great visual examples, because if you're starting up a mountain, everybody presumes you're going to the same place, right? Which is where?
The top.
You just presume that. So you have that image of a mountain, and you say, I'm not at the top of the mountain now. So this is, I'll use Herman's terminology. Here, my here is I'm down at the bottom of the mountain. My there is I want to be at the top of the mountain. So what I need to do is get a path to get from the bottom to the top. And that's just in its simplest form, leadership. And you can be a poor leader or an excellent leader. How would a poor leader go about that? I'm at the bottom of the mountain and I want to be at the top. What would you do?
Have someone carry you.
Oh, you could ask somebody to carry you? Okay, that'd be great. You could go around and poll everybody and see if anybody wants to go up this mountain. And then as soon as they start, run in front. A lot of politicians do it that way. Find a mountain that's already being climbed and claim that you're the leader of it. But even so, in a sense of just the definition of leadership, you could just start wandering up the mountain and not really be prepared to make it to the top. You could say, I'm just going to go up the mountain until I get tired, and then turn around and go back. But leadership is just getting from one place to another, from a here to a there. Excellent leadership is really what we're more interested in. And excellent leadership, you really have to have three characteristics to be an excellent leader. One is you have to have clarity. If you're not clear about which mountain you're going to climb, and what you mean by the top, and you can't explain it to anybody, then you're really not going to be an excellent leader. Okay, you have to have clarity about what your objective is. It's amazing in our world how fuzzy we are about the objectives that we want. When you had children, did you sit down and say, what is our goal for our children? What is it we really want to accomplish? Or did you just kind of assume that there was something that important and just kind of go stumbling along? Well, most of us just stumble along, and we assume that the other person knows what we don't know, or that it's just kind of obvious or something like that. And we typically don't really sit down and say, what is our goal for our children? Now, I think it's actually transcendent to have a goal for child rearing. And I would recommend that a good goal for child rearing, if you want to be outstanding leaders as parents, a great goal is to say, we want our children to leave home with the ability to make great value-based decisions. Well, that's a really good goal, because the child can't block it. You can make them leave. You don't have to have them stay at home. And you can inculcate with them with the ability to make good decisions, and then it's up to them whether they make them or not. That's a great goal for child rearing. Then all you have to do is have a plan. Okay, what age are they going to leave home? What stage of life are they going to leave home? And then you communicate it to them, and they understand, this is all the time I get here, and then I have to go there. And it creates clarity. More often, I think in our world, there's this unspoken underlying assumption that the goal of child rearing is for my children to validate me. All the things that I was not able to do in my life, my child will do on my behalf. So in order for that to be the case, I must control this child. and make sure that they do and create the appearances that are important for me to have. How's that going to work out? So, you know, clarity is really important. Having an objective that's definitive and can be communicated. Jim Collins wrote a book called Good to Great. And it has some terrific points in it. It's a bestseller, kind of management book. So this is kind of a business world. And in this book, Good to Great, he says one of the really important things about leadership are companies. What makes one company way better than another company in the same space is what the company's there for. And one of the interesting things he said, the companies that say we're here to make a profit actually do much worse than the companies that have something that goes way beyond profit. He had a consumer products company that he studied that was just like outperformed the other consumer products companies. And not the ones that went broke, but the ones that, you know, were viable, like by tenfold. And their company goal, their summit for their mountain, their there, was something along the lines of, we want to have the trust of our customers and provide them with consumer products that make their life better. So this particular company made Tylenol. And there was this scare where Tylenol was poisoned sometime in the past. And without even thinking about it, they just pulled it all off the shelves. It cost them a fortune. But their primary goal wasn't to make profits. They considered profits a byproduct. And as a result of that action, the trust in this company skyrocketed, and they just kept right on going. Now, Southwest Airlines has something similar. We really want our customers to have a great experience and have fun flying. And we want our staff to really love on the customers. My favorite Southwest Airlines trip is one of those short trips. And we were taking off, you know, and the nose of the plane was tilted straight up. And the stewardess comes on the loudspeaker and says, it's going to be a really short flight, so we're going to have to hurry with the snacks. Just take one and rake them down the aisle. And they just started throwing snacks down the aisle. And everybody was just, you know, take stuff and just pushing it back, paddling it back. It was just like a big party. It was hilarious. You know, they have no frills, and they have, you know, kind of a cattle car operation. It's a basic flying bus. And people love Southwest Airlines. Their on-time rate's great. You know, they're really apologetic. A lot of the other airlines are, you know, flight's late again. So you just thought you were going to get there on time. Well, we'll show you. Suckers. You know, that's kind of the attitude that you get from it, right? But Southwest is like, hey, we really care about you. When we screw up, and they're the only profitable airline. All the other ones are basically gone broke. Well, this is this good to great. You have a there, someplace on the summit that you want to go that is really meaningful. Well, that's the first point of excellent leadership, is clarity. The second point necessity for great, excellent leadership. We're not talking about great leadership yet. By the way, Herman walked in. Most of this I learned from Herman. So if I mess this up, it's my fault. If it's good, it's his fault. So the second thing is kind of reality. So if you've got this mountain and you have these people and say, let's go to the top of that mountain. Everybody says, yeah, let's go to the top of the mountain. And then you say, take three steps and say, here we are. Somebody says, what do you mean here we are? We're there. There's still a whole lot of elevation left. We only took three steps. Oh, come on. We're there. It's not reality, right? And this is kind of how we live. We kind of live without reality most of the time. You can't really have excellent leadership if you're not real about where you are. My favorite example of this is Napoleon Dynamite. There's a scene in Napoleon Dynamite where Napoleon Dynamite is talking to Pedro, his friend. And he says, I don't have a date to the prom. So well, what is his mountaintop? What's his there? What does he want? A prom date, right? What's his here? I don't have one. So Pedro asks, have you asked anybody? Okay, if you don't have a date and you want a date, what's the path? Ask somebody. Okay? So Napoleon says, I don't have any skills. You know, like nunchuck skills, computer hacking skills, you know, skills. Girls want guys that have skills. So what's he saying? There is no path between here and there. I can't ask anybody. Why? I don't have any skills. Right? So there's no basis for action. Hey, don't we do this all the time? The path, what's the path to get from here to there? We have a lack of reality. Well, if you're going to be a really good leader, you got to have clarity about where you're going, and you have to have reality about where you are. And if you're going to be an excellent leader, you have to have one other thing, which is commitment. The people that others want to follow are the ones that say, I'm here, I'm going there, and I'm getting there unless I die. That's who people want to follow. You can follow me or not. I'm going. Commitment. That's what people want to follow. So many of us are like, I want to lead. I'm here, I'm going there. Let's go. Come on, everybody. Come on. Hey, everybody, come on. Come on, we're going now. Okay, ready? 1, 2, 3, let's go. Hey, how come you guys aren't following? Come on. We're going now. Ready? Let's go. Why don't you go first, actually? You know, why don't you go first? Now, well, that's not commitment to objective. That's a desire to be followed. That's not leadership, excellent leadership. The best, worst example of excellent leadership that I can give you is from the book by Douglas Hyde called Dedication and Leadership. It's the best book because it is the best illustration. It's the worst book because of how chastising it is for Christians. Douglas Hyde was a Communist Party leader in England for 20 years. He resigned in 1948 after he saw Czechoslovakia fall and the promise of communism always make the world a better place. We're going to make the world a better place. Everything that's wrong with the world, we're fixing in our generation. That's an awesome goal. And he saw them take over Czechoslovakia and everything got way worse. Up until that point, it was like communism was taking over places that were bad and they're saying it's got to get a little worse first before it can get better. And they took over a free country and enslaved it and made everybody impoverished. And he said, okay, it's a lie. So he became a Christian and got involved in World Catholic Missions. And he writes this book in 1969. So he's been 20 years as a Catholic missionary. And he says, in this book, Dedication and Leadership, he says, I'm going to tell you how communism has taken over a third of the world, with never more than about 0.5% of the population as real party members. And I'm not going to tell you how bad communism is and all the wreckage that it's created. No telling how many hundreds of millions of people it's killed. I'm going to tell you how they're successful at achieving their objective. And he goes about describing this. And you know what they have? Clarity. They recruit people by saying, we're going to change the world in our generation. Now, who doesn't want to do that? Change the world in our generation. And we're going to eliminate the evils of the world, the oppression. Their favorite teaching method, Socratic method. You come to your own conclusions. We provide the definitions. If you buy my definition, you'll come to my conclusion. And they have reality. Every time they do an operation, which every operation they have has one goal, recruit Communist Party leaders. That's it. Recruit more communists. Recruit more Marxists. Move our narrative forward so we gain more power. That's it. And after every operation, they sit down and have a self-examination. They call it Bolshevik self-examination. did this work or not? Now, this is really ironic, since to the outside world, they obfuscate the there totally. They completely lie about it. What they do is they'll say something like, we have the hopeful change for all humanity to eliminate oppression and bring about freedom. And they mean it. And what they mean is a redefinition of every one of those words, that we would say, we want to take away all your choices and give them to the government, which happens to be us, the Marxists. But to themselves, they're very realistic. You know, is this working or not? And they have tremendous courage, especially with the lives of other people. They got clarity, they got reality, they got courage. And you know what they're doing? They're carrying out the Great Commission counterfeit. What did Jesus say? I'm going to reword the Great Commission. I want you to change the whole world by teaching them to live life the way I tell you to live life, so that you live free of the enslaving power and the death of sin. I want you to free the world in your generation. Go. Well, that's exactly what they say, except they redefine everything. It's the most important thing they redefine is who God is. It's them. And it's a form of self-worship. So that's the best worst example I know. One of the best good examples I know is Nehemiah. And in order to have great leadership, you have to have excellent leadership and add a few things. With clarity, you add truth. So be clear about where you're going, but make sure it's true. Well, if you have a goal to change the world, which is a good goal, should be all our goal, Great Commission. Change the world by teaching someone to live the commandments of God. And how can you do that if you're not living them yourself? Right? So, have this goal and have it be true. Of course, you can't have it be true without faith. Because we don't know enough to know what's true. So what we have to do is trust God, that what He tells us is true, and put it into action. So add to clarity, truth. And to reality, or the here, we add humility. Because in order to see reality the way it really is, we're going to have to bow ourselves before God. Remember Job? We went through Job. Job was the most righteous guy in all the earth, and never sinned with his lips, and didn't sin anyway that we're told of. What he did do is say, man, God, I want an audience with you. I think you're missing some perspective. And if I can explain that perspective to you, then you'll make it right for me. And God says, you're my favorite guy. I'm going to give you exactly what you asked for. We're going to have an audience about perspective. Let's start it this way. Tell me the perspective of how I sort of did things like light and gravity. And just explain that to me real quick. No, oh, don't have anything to explain from that? Okay. How about the tides and how the tides work? Explain that to me. Not just how they work, but how I did it. Okay, well, this is a little too high for you. I'll tell you what. Let's just downgrade it a little bit and just talk about two beasts, Leviathan and Behemoth. Let's just simplify this. Can you tame those guys? No, actually you can't. And if you try, you'll be sorry if you live through it. So let's just review this. You can't even comprehend what I did to make the world, how it operates, and you can't even tame one of the lowest, dumbest beasts that I made, and you want to explain the perspective to me that I'm missing. So what's wrong with this picture? And Job says, what's wrong with this picture is, I thought I was bigger than I was, and I'm small, and I get it now. And God says, that's just another reason I like you so much. Because you're willing to listen to truth when you see it. When reality presents itself, you embrace it because you got humility. And I just wanted you to see that while you're still alive on this earth so you can know it by faith. I don't want you to miss out on any knowing God by faith. Because humility is such a big deal. And the courage we have, if we want to be great leaders, is not just the courage, the commitment to get there no matter what, but the courage to get there even when everything we see tells us it's not worthwhile. Because we have to have the eyes of faith to look out and say, it is worth it, because God said so. So that's what great leadership looked like. We're going to have the courage and the commitment if we're going to get from here to there. And there's true. And here we see with the humility, eyes of humility, so we can see what God's telling us is true. We're going to have the courage to prepare. When the opportunity comes, when the door opens, we're going to have to act. We're going to expect difficulty. It's going to come. We're going to expect it. We're prepared for it. When it comes, we've already decided we're not stopping. Okay, we're going to make it through this no matter what. And all this has to be done with the eyes of faith if we want to be great leaders. So let's look at Nehemiah. And let's just look at some examples here. Nehemiah chapter 1. So the words of Nehemiah. So this is actually written by Nehemiah. So he talks to one of his buddies. In verse 3, they said to him, 1 verse 2, and then Hanana, one of my brethren, a fellow Jew, came with men from Judah. So Nehemiah is in the capital of Babylon. We're at something, you know, 600 something, sorry, 5 something BC, 500 something BC. The Jews, you know, Abraham's 2,000. Moses 1500, David Saul like 1000. 586 is when the Babylonian captivity happens. So this, the Babylonian captivity has happened. A bunch of people are in the Babylonian capitals in Babylon, and now Persia has come in and conquered Babylon. So now we're under Persian rule. That's the historical setting. So they came from Judah. So these are some people coming from Judah. And I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped, who had survived the captivity. Because when this 586 thing happened, some people were taken out, a few people left, and many people died. And concerning Jerusalem. And they said to me, the survivors who are left from the captivity in the province are in great distress and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates are burned with fire. So when I heard these words, that I sat down and wept and mourned for many days. I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven, and I said, I pray, Lord God of heaven, O great and awesome God, you who keep your covenants and mercy with those who love you and observe your commandments, please let your ear be attentive and your eyes open, that you may hear the prayer of your servant, which I pray before you now, day and night, for the children of Israel, your servants, and confess the sins of the children of Israel, which we have sinned against you. Both my father's house and I have sinned. We have acted very corruptly against you and have not kept the commandments, the statutes, nor the ordinances which you commanded your servant Moses. Remember, I pray, the word that you commanded your servant Moses, saying, if you're unfaithful, I will scatter you among the nations. So what do we have here? We've got current reality. And humility. Because he doesn't come in when he gets this report. He doesn't say, oh, well, it must not be as bad as you're saying. Or, glad I don't live in Jerusalem. Or maybe we ought to just kind of let Jerusalem go. But he's got the faith to understand this is our capital. This is our homeland. This is where the temple is supposed to be. This is our center of worship. And until that's rebuilt, we don't have our fellowship with God the way it's supposed to be. And our reality is right now we're under reproach. And we're under reproach because we're under judgment and it's our fault. It's my fault. And he's now coming in total humility and prayer before God saying, this is my fault. And he's coming with the belief and the faith that God's truth says, this happened because you disobeyed. So far, we've got leadership in action here. And then he says, verse 9, but you also said, Nehemiah, talking to God, if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though some of you were cast out to the farthest parts of the heavens, yet I will gather them from there and bring them to the place where I've chosen dwelling for my name. Now these are your servants and your people whom you've redeemed by your great power and by your strong hand. Oh Lord, I pray, please, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and the prayer of your servants who desire to fear your name, and let your servant prosper this day. I pray, and grant him mercy in the sight of this man, the king. For I was the king's cupbearer. Now the king's cupbearer, that doesn't sound like an important position. But in this kind of world of monarchs, you can listen, you know, go and watch some Shakespeare plays on BBC or something if you want to see this. Somebody's always trying to poison the king. His sons, the next in line, maybe his wife, you know, somebody's always looking for that throne of power. And so being the king's cupbearer was like, you were one of the most trusted guys. He's got to believe that no poison's coming into my mouth. So it came to pass in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was before him, that I took the wine and gave it to the king. Now, I'd never been sad in his presence before. Therefore, the king said to me, why is your face sad since you're not sick? This is nothing but sorrow of heart. So I became dreadfully afraid. So it was a capital offense to be sad in the presence of a monarch. Now, you know, you watch like television news shows and stuff like that. What do you always see on the face of whoever's being interviewed? A really big fake smile, right? You know, they've done these studies, and all that really matters is what someone's face and their overall characteristic looks like. And it almost doesn't matter what they say. If you look all happy, people come away with a real favorable impression. It almost doesn't matter how stupid you look when you do that. You just come away with a favorable impression. Well, I imagine you got to see a lot of that in these throne rooms. But he's sad. And the king says, why are you sad? And I was dreadfully afraid. Why? Because now he's in danger of losing his head. Now, what had he prayed to God? Give me favor with this man today. Is that clear? Is that clear what he's at? And why? Because he wants to take away the reproach of Israel. He wants God to restore. So here you have real great leadership. I think the most important thing about great leadership, other than these principles here, and putting it into action, is to understand the difference between commitment and results. If we have the courage to be committed to live a discipleship life and to teach others as we go, we have to believe we're changing the world even if we're rejected. We have to believe that we are doing what needs to be done even if we're killed for it. That's courageous commitment. And here you got Nehemiah. He's got the humility to see reality as it is. He now has an objective to restore Jerusalem. But he understands that this is in the hands of God. I can't. If I'm sad in the presence of the king, from a human perspective, I'm losing my head. I'm going to need God's help. And if this is the time, that's fine. If it's not, it's fine. But as for me, I'm committed. So verse 3, I said to the king, may the king live forever. As best I understand it, this was what you had to say like the first phrase of any interaction with the king. Morning, Dave, how are you? Oh, king, may you live forever. I'm fine this morning. You want a donut? No, I'm trying to lose a little weight. You going to have a donut? Yes, O king, live forever. May you live forever. I think I'll have. It'd be kind of cumbersome, really, wouldn't it? I don't know what these conversations are. But apparently that's what they cared about. So he says, why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's tombs, lies waste and its gates are burned with fire? Then the king said to me, what do you request? Now, if Nehemiah was not a great leader, he wouldn't be prepared for this. He would say, well, you know, let me get back to you. Okay? That's not what he says. So I prayed to the God of heaven. You know, prayers can be long and they can be short. He's like, okay, this is it, God. I need your grace right now. And he's prepared. And he says to the king, if it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, ask that you send me to Judah. Now again, we see commitment here. Courageous commitment, right? He's got a plan. What could he have said? Send somebody to Judah. That's not what he says. Send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it. I don't know why he emphasizes father's tombs there. I've been to Petra and seen the sort of ridiculous, extravagant emphasis that's put on tombs, and just presume that that would have been a way to request in a manner where it would generate empathy with the king. So I presume here that Nehemiah didn't get to be a cupbearer for the king as a foreigner without some degree of shrewdness. So I'm just going to assume that this is really shrewd. Then the king said to me, verse 6, the queen also sitting beside him, how long will your journey be and when will you return? Presumably he had an answer for that too. He's prepared. Has goal. It's based in truth. He understands what God has said about his nation and Jerusalem. He got that from the scripture, remember, in the prayer. He's got reality about what things are like right now, including that he might lose his head. But he's got the courage and the commitment to go. And he's even ready to answer a question about how long is it going to take. So it pleased the king to send me, and I set him a time. Furthermore, I said to the king, if it pleases the king, let letters be given to me for the governors of the region beyond the river, that they must permit me to pass through till I come to Judah. So he had also done his research. See, this preparation thing's a big deal. And he understood what it was going to take to make it all the way to the top. And he's prepared to pay the price. So the king granted to him, and he goes through the governors. And then verse 11, he comes to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. So he's been there 3 days. Then I arose in the night, and I and a few men with me, and I told no one what God had put in my heart to do at Jerusalem. So now not only do we have an objective to get to the top, to get there, and it be true, he's saying, I'm doing this because God laid it on me. This is what God put in my heart. Which again goes back to humility. You know, seeing reality for what it really is not... You can have Bolshevik self-examination and be pragmatic about it, but to see things truly as they are, we've got to have Job's perspective and see what God's telling us. And he's got this. God has put this in his heart. You know, it's interesting. Jim Collins also wrote a book called Built to Last. And Built to Last... identifies what the defining characteristic of these stellar companies is. And whereas Good to Great was like they have something that their company's about, a there, that goes beyond just profit, Built to Last says whoever's leading the company puts the there above their own ego. And they serve people to get to the there. That's the defining character. That's what separates one company from another. Well, we'll see that here in a minute with Nehemiah. And there wasn't any animal with me except the one on our road. So I went out by night, this is verse 13, through the valley gate to the serpent wall, the refuge gate. And I viewed the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down and its gates were burned with fire. So he's going out here and he's doing a nighttime reconnaissance with just a handful of people without telling anybody what his deal is. What do you think he's doing? Why is he doing this? Yeah, he's getting a current reality. He wants to know himself, what is our real current state? Because when you put a bold, audacious goal out in front of people, the normal thing for people to do is say, oh, well, yeah, good luck with that. I'm too busy. I got fantasy football today. I mean, he wants to know exactly what he's dealing with before he tells people what his what the goal is going to be here. Then I went on to the fountain gate and the king's pool, and there was no room for the animal under me to pass. There's so much rubble and debris. So it's a bad state of affairs, I think, is what he's telling us here. So I went up in the night by the valley and viewed the wall. So he couldn't do it. Jerusalem was built right on the edge of some valleys. And I think what he's telling us here is, I couldn't get through, so I actually had to go down in the valley and look up. Verse 16, and the officials did not know where I'd gone or what I'd done, and I hadn't yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, or the others who did the work we're about to learn about. Then I said to them, you see the distress we're in, how Jerusalem lies waste, and its gates are burned with fire. So what's he giving them? What would we call that? The reality. Here. Okay, this is where we are, right? It's current reality. Anybody there going to like that? They're not going to like it, but it's just current reality. What is it you say, Herman? Current reality is an acquired taste? So he's giving them current reality. This is where we are. We can say we're not. Well, this is where we are. And if somebody is going to say, oh, it's not that bad, what does he have? He saw it with his own eyes that last night, right? Then he says, come and let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer be a reproach. So here we are today. Our here is, we're a reproach. Three cheers for reproach. Anybody want to stay in that? No. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to take away a reproach. And the first step in doing that is rebuild this wall. So, this is interesting too about great leadership. You have to have a there that goes beyond any tangible action. It's the Great Commission. I want you to change the whole world by teaching everybody in it to obey my commandments in your generation. Anybody take that on by yourself? And then he gives us, and here's what I want you to do. I want you to live it in your daily life. And every time somebody asks you, how come you're doing that? Tell them. So he gives us this transcendent mountain summit type of objective, and then something really simple to do every day. Well, how do I do that every day? Give somebody a cup of cold water in my name. How complicated is that? Okay, so he says, we're going to take away the reproach. Start by building the wall. And they said, let's do it. We're with you. Now, he also told them that the king had given him all this benefit. I mean, all this support. So I'm sure that was an important part of this as well. So, then, Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem hear about it. So they started a laughing campaign, a ridicule campaign. And they said, ha ha, you're rebelling against the king. Are they rebelling against the king? No, they're not. They've got the king's blessing. But that's not the way you discourage people. So they start a misinformation campaign. These guys are rebelling against the king. I remember not that long ago when they came and knocked all this down and killed everybody? They're going to do it to you again because you're rebelling against the king. Make them stop. Pretty nice campaign. But Nehemiah has an answer. And he says, God, our God of heaven himself will prosper us. Therefore you will rise and build that you have no heritage. But you have no heritage or right or memorial in Jerusalem. So then, Nehemiah does something else that's indicative of great leadership. He gets 38, Brandon counted them for me, 38 different groups. And he gives each one of them a section of the wall. There's three different kinds of groups. We see them in the first three verses here. Then Eliashib, the high priest, rose up with his brethren, the priests, and built the sheep gate. So we got this company. this group of workers that work together. They have already have a leader, and the leader organizes the people, and they have a section. So if you're really going to accomplish something big, you got to make the objective clear, and then you have to give leaders the freedom to figure it out for themselves. We don't see Nehemiah sitting there, you know, instructing them about every brick and how to repair the wall. Just, you can figure this out. Here's your section. Make it happen. So now what we have is self-governance kicking in. We have leadership and we have delegation. And real delegation is, I'm going to pick someone who's capable. I'm going to give them the clear parameters. And then I'm going to let them figure out how to get it done. First group is kind of a company, if you will. A group of workers that work together. Next, verse 2. Eliashib, the men of Jericho built. So the next group we have is a community. So a community comes together and Jericho says, hey, we'll take a section. So the guys come over from Jericho, about, I don't know, what is it, 30 miles or something? Up the Jericho Road. And they come over and say, we'll take a section. This is just like a Habitat project. So you got companies. You got Rotary Club. You got City of Stanton coming over. Okay, and then the third thing is the sons of Hasaniah built the fish gate. So you got a family. So you get a family clan gets together. The head of the clan kind of organizes people. It's interesting in here. There's one group that says this guy and his daughters built it. And there's another one that's real interesting. It says this clan came together to build this section, but their nobles wouldn't work. wouldn't you love to be in the Bible because you're a lazy bum? When it came? So he has a clear objective. And he delegates. They've got their assigned spots. And then comes these three bad guys. And this time, the misinformation campaign didn't work, but this time they've got armed resistance. So, they recruit an army. Put them at the foot of the wall. Half the people watch. Half the people work. A lot of the workers carry a weapon in one hand, work with the other hand. How would you like to repair a wall with a sword in your hand, you know? But what they're doing is, it's not all that practical. What it is it's a visual demonstration of these guys. We will fight to the death for this. Come on. And Nehemiah says, hey, if they attack, let's all rally to this point. When the horn blows, everybody go there. This is our muster spot. Because he's not turning back. And in 52 days... they got the wall repaired. 52 days. So, he is a great example of leadership. He's got the humility to take God's perspective on current reality and embrace it. He sees God's truth about what it is we're trying to get done and about where we are today. And he's got the courage and commitment to not only leave the results up to God, but to act courageously when the opportunity presents itself, no matter what. He's seeing beyond his own life. He's got the wisdom to plan so that when the opportunity comes, he can embrace it. He has no illusion. He expects difficulty. He asked the king for a letter. He expected the difficulty. He's not going to let it stop him, no matter what. And he's dedicated to persevere. Well, this is great leadership. And we can apply it to child rearing, job, marriage, friendships, church, ministry, anything in our lives, we can apply this. And it starts with, God, what do you want me to do? Where am I today? What is my current reality? Having a repentant heart, standing before God in humility. And then it goes to, what do you want me to do? Where do you want me to go? He wants us all to do the same thing. Teach others to obey His commandments and live in Himself. Well, how do I get started? Cup of cold water. What's a cup of cold water for me? Who's right in my field of view? What task do I have at work or at home or with my friends I can do that's teaching them by example of living? Well, what's the smallest thing I can do that's the biggest thing in your sight? Because what I want to do is please you. And then planning, being ready to act, having the courage and commitment to overcome difficulty when it comes, expecting it, and have the eyes of faith to see all this through God's perspective. That's great leadership. Nehemiah is a great example. God, thank you for this wonderful example of leadership and for your truth, for reality as you present it, and for the promises that you've given us that if we'll believe them by faith, give us the ability to transcend all the woes of this life, looking forward to all the great things you're going to do with the difficulties that we encounter. I pray that you'll help us learn the lesson of Job and get small in our own eyes so that we can see reality. I pray that you'll help us embrace this audacious thing you ask us to do, to change the world in our generation, by doing our part and believing that we're changing the world and all of eternity by being faithful in small things. And I pray that you'll give us the courage to be committed to do that on a daily basis, no matter what the opposition, no matter how much misinformation, no matter how much pain and suffering, no matter how much objection that we get from others. And it is in your holy name we pray. Amen.